You can eat and podcast.
I haven't eaten since I left home.
I haven't eaten either.
I find it difficult to believe.
No, really. I had some fairy cake.
What's fairy cake?
You know, fairy cake, what you have at birthday parties. You know, butter, fairy things.
Hundreds and thousands.
Yeah, fairy cake.
Fairy bread.
Yeah.
It's on bread, it's fairy bread.
It was on bread.
It's fairy bread.
I had some. It's yum.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and joining me this fine, sunny Saturday afternoon is your other host, Ian Mond.
Hello.
Hello.
Monthly. We're not monthly. We haven't been monthly for months.
That was your fault last month. Why?
No.
Why was it your fault?
Because my wife had a baby.
Because, well, I think she had a bit of help with having that baby.
Yeah, but I only was involved 9 and 10 months ago.
What you're about to say for 9 or 10 seconds.
You know far too much about us. Yes, true, both. But yes, so she, Sophie Zara,
yes.
Mond.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
There's another Mond in the world.
Yes, who's now currently 3 weeks old today. No, 3 weeks old yesterday.
Oh, you forget already.
22 days. No, I couldn't forget already.
Yesterday, today, maybe tomorrow. I don't know. She's about a month.
You're disgraceful. You don't forget. Well, you do a little bit. I mean, I'm getting Joshy and Sophie's names both mixed up and their birthdays.
Their names.
Well, so, because Sophie looks like Joshy as a little baby.
She's a baby.
Yeah. No, as a baby, they're identical.
But Joshy's not a baby anymore.
Oh, my God. If you put a picture of Joshua with a picture of Sophie at the same age, they look very similar. In fact, I think Sophie will look a bit mannish. Oh,
That's the worst thing you could have said.
Oh, probably. That's gender essential.
That's really bad.
Yeah.
And it's your daughter as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm leaving that one in.
Okay. Well, she can always look when she's older, she can listen back and yell at me.
Oh, she will. Yeah, in fact, I might clip that out, put it in a birthday card when she's 18, because by then there'll be sort of holographic birthday cards, and that will, she'll open her birthday card and it will say, I think she's going to look a bit mannish.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, because I'm not a gender essentialist. You know, we're not dressing her
a little bit.
We're not dressing her in much pink.
Oh, do you know, I was in Kmart the other day.
Yeah.
I got so stabby because I just had to buy something. But to get to the something I had to buy, I had to walk through children's clothing. And it literally is. You walk through girls' clothing and it's pink and lavender.
Yeah.
Pink and lavender, pink and lavender, pink and lavender. That's it.
Yeah.
And then you cross this imaginary line into boys' clothing and it's green and blue and brown and orange. And
it, the problem
is, God.
The problem is, and I know this is integral to our podcast, but the problem is that when we dress Sophie in non-gender colours, so neutral colours, or non-perceived gender colours.
Yes, yep.
I don't know how to say
I
that.
I know what
yes,
you mean.
Thank you. The people call her a boy. It's interesting.
But
the default
is
a boy.
Problem,
no, but it's a default. They don't assume she's a girl. They assume she's a boy if she's in neutral colours, so not boy colours.
We've covered this, haven't we, Ian?
Yes, the stick men. We did the stick men. But it's just something I've...
The default is male, unless you specify otherwise.
But look, I'm becoming aware of these things. Now that I have a daughter,
yeah.
It's now becoming even more of a thing.
Welcome to the terror.
Yes. No, just, you know, that people assume that she's a boy because she's not wearing pink. She is wearing pink, though, because there will be a lot of pink. I went to a 3-year-old birthday party today. There was
it was all pink. Yeah.
Pink to the little, but the little girl liked the pink. Maybe she didn't know any better. That's, yeah.
We don't Josh, need to get into this debate.
No, I know Josh
this,
was a bit nonplussed about
podcast.
It all. Yeah, true. Anyway, so that's my news. I've had a child. Jules did very little. Yes. Oh, I had to cut the cord thing. And I'm sure.
Did you have someone to mop your brow? That would have been hard work.
I needed it. So that was my news.
Okay.
But we have bigger news. No, it's sorry. It's not.
All right. No, that's the worst thing you said. You're so lucky Jules doesn't listen to this podcast.
No, she doesn't listen to some of the beginnings. That's the problem.
Probably the beginning, I'd say. Hi, Jules.
Yeah. So we won a Ditmar as well.
We won a Ditmar.
Now, you were there at the, because I didn't
was
go,
there.
So tell us about it.
I went to Conflux.
Well, tell me about it, because you haven't told me anything.
I feel really bad, actually, because, my novel Perfections was nominated in the best novel category.
They didn't win.
But I knew I wouldn't, because Margot Lanigan and Kate Forsyth each had a novel in that category as well as other books. But I mean, it was always going to be Margot, Kate, one of those two.
Why do you put yourself down like that?
Because it's Margot Lanigan and Kate Forsyth.
So what? You're Kirsten McDermott. No, I don't accept that.
So let me continue with my story. Don't stop it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I went, great, no chance of winning. Whew, don't need to worry about an acceptance speech. Don't need to worry about what I'm wearing. It's fine. I can sit back, relax. And then they start reading out the awards, and they read out the list of nominees first, and it's like, best fan production. Right, and they're reading out the nominees, and we're first. I went, oh, that's right, we're nominated for this one too.
You'd forgotten we were nominated for The Writer and the Critic.
I had completely forgotten. But then they're reading through the list of nominees, and it's Galactic Suburbia and Coode Street and The Snapshot, which I voted for because I think The Snapshot is an awesome project, and so many hundreds of hours of work went into that. And I thought, that's got to win. It's won the last two times it was nominated.
It was, and I was involved relaxed. In The Snapshot. It was a lot of work. Yep. Yes.
So, you know, I was still quite relaxed. Like, oh, well, The Snapshot's got that one. And then they said it was us. It was really cool. So I went up there.
I actually am flummoxed. I'll be honest, I am genuinely flummoxed.
I was genuinely surprised, like, because I got reminded that we were nominated for an award, which is cool. So I said, oh, that's right. Oh, lovely.
real investment in this podcast, aren't you, Kirsten?
It
was great, but great investment. You know, the fact that
you care more about your own fiction than this podcast. I felt bad.
What's going to get you bigger name in this world, this podcast or your own fiction? And by the way,
no, that's the worst thing that you can say.
Can I just say, just don't do that. Bogo and Kate, you are granted fantastic writers, granted fantastic books, but don't lower yourself.
I'm just acknowledging that these other two fine books, both of which I read, I'm not just saying, oh, it's Margot and Kate, therefore one of them will win. I read both those books. They were both brilliant.
Do you think your book was as good?
No.
Really? You really believe, as the author, that your book was not as good as
Sea Hearts is an astonishing book. I wish I had written Sea Hearts. It is so good on so many levels. I love Peter Green's too, but I think Sea Hearts just nudges ahead for me as well. So.
All right, fine, okay.
But I did win another award though.
Yeah. What? You got more news?
I've won the Australian Shadows for my novel because Margot and Kate weren't in the category. Because they don't write horror. Well, they kind of do, but not for those.
So you're officially making you the third best writer in Australia at the moment.
Either.
No, I'm putting it in your mouth.
No, So Perfections did win the Australian Shadows.
Yeah, well, congratulations.
Which is really lovely.
What was the award this time? Another rotted zombie? Or?
No, it's really cool. It's a replica human skull.
You've got like 23 of those in your house.
No,
Did you need another?
Not a replica human skull. I've got
actual
skull things, but this is like properly made and made to look old and stuff.
Oh, really?
That pattern. It hasn't arrived yet, but I've seen the photos. It looks really, really cool.
Is it better than the zombie thing?
It's smaller.
Because that zombie thing was huge.
The zombie award is still in its box.
It's bigger than Sophie.
Post-move, I haven't found a place for it yet. It's quite big. I'm thinking replica human skull, not so big, kind of skull size, already have a spot.
Like if Jules had given birth to the zombie thing.
I think you'd have big, big fucking problems.
And they'd weighed. It would have weighed more than Sophie.
Yeah, it's pretty heavy.
Yeah.
It's pretty heavy.
Well, congratulations.
So that's
who are you up against for
babies and was, my husband, embarrassingly.
And he was nominated for the Dittmar as well.
Wasn't he
for Best Novel?
Yes, Salvage.
But for Salvage, yeah.
For Salvage, yes. So, and also Lee Battersby's novel was also nominated for The Australian Shadows, The Corpse Rat King.
But you beat both of them.
I did. I have a skull coming my way at some point.
That's lovely. So is that all the news that we've got in the 6 weeks we didn't do a podcast? Is that all?
I think that's all that happened. I think a baby and two awards is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
That's quite a busy month.
Yeah.
Really?
It's reasonably hectic. And you accepted the Dittmar on our behalf.
I did. And it's very pretty.
And you're keeping this one.
I am because you will be keeping the one from last year when we finally get it.
When?
Well, it's probably soon.
Yeah.
I have it on good authority. All the pieces of the Lego Dittmars are in the country and have been. It's just I think the Continuum people have been really busy in the last couple of months putting their new convention on. So, yeah.
But what about me, though? I mean,
well, you...
who cares about how busy they've been? How long does it take to put some Lego together? Well, give it to me. I'll do it.
I suggested they should just send all the Lego out with instructions of how to put your Lego Ditmar together, and it could be a DIY Ditmar, and you could do other things with it, and then you could send them a photo if you didn't actually make it as per the instruction sheet. You might make something else.
This was a suggestion you had?
Yes.
You really got to stop doing
that. I'll make a pony. I'm really good at making Lego ponies. That's all I used to make when I was a kid.
The other good news is that, ponies aside, the other good news is that our hiatuses are over.
We're back to monthly.
This is now a monthly podcast.
For the foreseeable future, which obviously does not include unforeseeable.
Well, if I can be here now, given that Jules has given me a guild trip because we're doing two podcasts today.
That's not too right in the critic. No, people. Sorry to get you excited.
Yeah, no, we're doing a shooting the poo as well. This is probably the worst time because she's 3 weeks old. Next time we do one, it'll be at Continuum. She'll be 7 weeks old. And then when we're back here, it'll be nearly 3 months old. I mean, she's literally going to university at that point.
Oh, yeah, you can just abandon them. Correct. They can do their own shopping,
that's right.
Sit up, the whole thing. She's so wrestling the remote controls off them because they want to watch, you know, something
absolutely.
Like Glee.
Absolutely. So, what are we doing today?
We should probably start with the books. So we're back to our we are only going to do two books. We've decided we're never going to do three or four again. That was a bit silly. So we are doing two books. I've recommended one. You've recommended one. And let's do the one that I've recommended first.
Which is?
It's called Feed. And it's by an author called M.T. Anderson. And this was the first book of his that I'd read. It was thrust.
I didn't know it was a he.
Okay.
Do you know I thought it was a woman?
Oh, okay. That doesn't really make any difference.
No, it doesn't, but I just thought, I don't know why I defaulted to a woman.
Because often a lot of still, unfortunately, sad, angry-making, a lot of female authors do feel the need, especially if they're writing in a perceived male genre such as science fiction, to use initials because their books will sell more if people think they might be a man.
Oh.
So often, like the collective wisdom is that you use initials so that your gender is masked and therefore people will default assume you're a male, but often if you know about this stuff as you do, you might assume initials mean, oh, it's a woman pretending not to be a woman. Whether you went through that conscious thought process, that's probably why.
Well, you're giving me a headache, so possibly. Okay, so MT is a MT.
Matthew, I think. Matthew Tobin.
MT. The word empty? Okay. Matthew Anderson.
So, this was the first I had read of his. I had this book thrust upon me by Bren McDibble, actually, who's a really good author. And she said, you have to read this. It's really, really good. You have to read it. You have to read it. You have to read it.
It was written in 2001, wasn't it?
2002. So, yeah.
So, when did she voice this on you? 11 years ago?
Last year. Okay. She said, you have to read it. She brought it to a writing retreat we were on. And she said, you need to read this. And I said, okay.
Is it young adult? Because I didn't.
It's young adult by virtue of, you know, the default these days, which seems to be it has teenage characters, therefore it's young adult.
So I wouldn't have thought it was young adult. It's just the word fuck is everywhere in it.
But young adult is it these days?
Does it really?
Yeah, it
so
does.
Then what's the difference then?
It's for teenagers. Come on, 16, 17-year-olds are reading this stuff. What, they're not swearing?
Yeah, of course they are. But
middle grade wouldn't have, like, children's and middle grade wouldn't have that much swearing in it.
Okay, but why is this then? This is written as if it's written to an adult audience. It doesn't feel like
it's
written.
No, it's written for a teenage audience.
Is it?
Teenagers don't want to read Enid Blyton.
Oh, for fuck's sakes.
No, seriously.
I suppose the way I see it is once you get to teenage, you're reading adult books anyway. You don't really need a niche.
But no.
But it's a whole young adult discussion, I know.
Yes, and then there's, what's the new one? Yeah. New adult. Oh, it makes me sick.
You made that up for this podcast.
No, I did not make that up.
Bullshit,
that
there's something called new adult.
You haven't seen the new adult genre?
What the fuck does
new
that
adult,
even mean?
New adult. Oh, well, new adult is for young adults who are older, so they're like early 20s, late teens, early 20s kind of thing.
Read a fucking novel, novel.
No, pretty soon we're going to get a point. You're 37, here's your books. When you're 38, come back, we'll give you more.
Are you serious as a new adult category?
New adult. Well, it's a marketing thing, but a lot of these things start out as marketing.
Yeah, but they'll get a prize. You know, there'll be a category.
So it's kind of sort of flag to be young adult, but with a bit more sex and swearing. But as I've said, there's so much sex and swearing in young adult fiction already. I'm not entirely sure what the difference is, except that the characters will be older. Instead of being in their mid to late teens, the characters will be in their late teens and early 20s, and that's new adult. And if should you get to be 30, maybe there's a whole other bunch of books for you. In fact, there probably is. If you're a girl, it's called commercial women's fiction. And then when you get older...
Oh, people have missed us. Well, there's midlife crisis.
Sad.
Adult.
No, there's... well,
demented adult for when you're in your 90s. And
it's just... Anyway.
So, yeah. Okay. So this is not new adult. This is young adult.
I'm rant over. Yes. So anyway, it's a book.
Yes.
It's a book. I really like Garth Nix's definition of young adult. Have you heard that?
Yes, I think on the Cood Strip. But say it again.
Basically, you know, leaving aside, you know, nitty gritty definitions of content and language and what's in there and what isn't and what's allowed and what isn't and age of all that sort of stuff. Garth Nix says the way you look at young adult is it's a genre that it's a starting point. The age is a starting point.
Okay.
So it's not that, oh, these are books for kids.
Yes,
it's,
gotcha.
You know, anyone can read them. It's just, you know, you could start a bit younger.
Yeah, again, there's the prejudice within me, and it's coming out loud and clear, that I obviously think young adult is baby. And
every time I do a young adult prejudice book on this podcast, you get really surprised.
I know. And I know. It's like,
this is young adult. I wouldn't have known.
It's a goldfish thing. There's
they weren't eating fairy bread.
It's hundreds and thousands. It just makes it. Gives it that crunch.
I hate it. They get stuck in your teeth.
No, they don't.
All that
just
butter. It's butter and sugar and white. It's poison. It's not food. Don't feed that to your children, people.
You've got no sense of fun. Can you please tell us what the feed is about? And if you start talking about zombies and mention Myra Grant...
No, that's the other feed. Yes. This is a different feed.
I had to throw
feed.
That in. Cause...
Yes. Well, yes, it will get a little confusing. No. So, okay, so it's basically a nearish alternate future.
Yes.
Because as we said, it was written in 2002, but it has quite a lot of resonance, doesn't it? Ten years later, it doesn't feel dated.
No, in fact,
it doesn't feel dated.
Whether it feels more relevant today, potentially.
It does, doesn't it? And it doesn't feel, because we'll get to it in a minute, but he doesn't feel dated in the way that, say, Neuromancer feels dated in terms of the tech. You kind of read Neuromancer now and you just feel
28 years later.
That, well, even if you read it 10 years ago, I think that feels like it's a tech that verged off. You could look at it as an alternate future that came from, you know, the time it was written and then it went that way.
Okay, so you're saying if you'd read Neuromancer in 95...
And that future doesn't really look much like our future now,
you're
right?
saying if you'd read Neuromancer in 95, you'd already feel dated.
I think you'd already feel like that is a world that we will never get to. That's something that diverged back when Gibson wrote Neuromancer. Whereas this feels like it could still be just around
the corner,
just
read an article
right?
about Google Glasses.
Exactly.
And this is Google Glasses.
Yeah, so this feels like it could just be just around the corner still. It doesn't feel dated in the sense that this is something that, oh, we'll never get there now. That was a completely imagined timeline that, we now know is never going to be a reality. This still feels really, really current. So basically we're looking at a nearish future world where in America at least, because we don't hear much about the rest of the world except that they don't like America. 73% of its citizens are hooked into what's simply known as the feed.
Yep.
Which is basically having your Google chip that I think we have joked about in the past. And most people, this seems to be about a second, maybe third-ish generation.
Yep.
So most kids are given the technology and it's incorporated into
most
you.
Privileged kids.
Well, 73% is getting there. That's a lot. That's not just privileged.
Yeah, but
kids.
I mean, the book is a lot also about class. I mean,
but I'm just saying it's
okay,
that's,
fine. All right, yeah, no, keep going.
73% isn't just your cream who can afford it.
Yeah.
Like by this generation, previous generations it was more expensive and less adopted, but by this generation we're talking about almost everyone of these kids, right? So the technology's obviously gotten to the point where it's cheap enough and ubiquitous enough that pretty much every baby has this put in them. So Sophie would have it now.
Yes.
Right? It'd be like getting your inoculations.
Yes.
Getting your feed. And because there's problems if you get your feed later, your body might kind of reject it because it's a technology that's incorporated into your biomass. So, you know, it becomes part of you biologically and it's it's not something you can take out or switch on or off.
Yep.
Until you have to fix it sort of thing. So everyone's got the feed, which is essentially the internet in your head. And everyone can sort of Google chat to each other, which is essentially a form of telepathy because everyone could just IM each other basically in their heads without needing to verbalize or write anything down. Yep. It's just all in your head. It's like having the internet in your head 24/7, basically. You get bombarded with ads and banners and info. You don't need to learn much because the feed will give you the stuff you want, the word you need. What's that thing? Oh, that's what that thing is. You know, all of this stuff. So it's fed to you. Feed is such – Myra Grant did it nicely with her book too, and feed is such a lovely word to yep. use for this kind of thing because there's so many layers of meaning. So that's kind of the world. And our main character who through whom we see the world is Titus, and he's about 16?
He's 16, 17, yeah.
And he's with his friends and they go to the moon because you can.
That's probably the only science fictional stuff that doesn't have resonance because pissing off to the moon on a lark, which is literally what they do. They get up and just off they go.
Sure.
Unless this is set,
but you know, Virgin just launched their. This is what I mean.
This isn't. No, see, because there are a couple of anachronistic things in this. I don't mean to provide opinion before you've even done the plot. But for example, they're still using the current rating systems. So when they're doing the ads for films, they're still using NC-17.
Sure.
So obviously it's not 150 years into the future. It's more like tomorrow plus 20.
Yeah.
And I don't really think they're going – and you could go to bloody Jupiter or something as well. It's not just the moon or Mars or somewhere else on a lark, you know, if you've got the money. You don't
– Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, I guess the – you know, when I say like it still feels like something you get – like the resonances are still there. And a lot of the stuff they're talking about, it's still like tiny little
details.
Except
for the planetary travel, yes.
Yeah. Tiny little bits sort of jar. We go, yeah, we're probably not going to have, you know – planetary travel for the price
solar
of a trip
travel,
to Europe
whatever you want to call
something.
It, yeah.
But I mean, the kids who are going to the moon as a lark, you get the feeling that it's like, it's not just, oh, yes, we went up to the Gold Coast for schoolies. It would be the equivalent of sort of like a trip to Europe. Violet's father saved up for a year to send her to the moon. This is not a quick trip.
Violet is the love interest, correct?
Yeah.
Violet is a whole separate kettle of fish.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is...
Forgive Violet
Yeah,
for
but
the moment.
What I'm saying, the trip to the moon is not like, oh, we pay $250 and we go to the Gold Coast for the weekend.
No, but for them it is, exactly that.
Yeah, but because they're rich enough to do that. I'm saying we have people now who go, oh, we'll just go to America for the weekend, right? And they'll pay their $5,000 and they'll go to America for 5 days and come back and they've had their weekend in Las Vegas.
Okay, fair point.
Right, but...
Wrong, but fair point. it just the way the book reported it is that for most
people...
Yeah,
but this is how Titus feels.
Yeah, well, okay, we're through his eyes. Okay, but yeah, all right.
What? You can't afford to go to the moon?
It's a side issue.
Unit,
it's a side issue.
I love the slang. I think, actually, just on a side point, I think...
You're talking about the slang?
The language that Anderson's used in this book is really clever because he's invented his own slang. So none of the words that they're using feel dated. Because it's new. He's just invented slang. And it's very organic slang. You don't need – like there's a couple little jarring bits as you're reading into the book. But it's really easy to pick up.
Yeah, I noted
it's
when
really
I was reading it actually slang with the slang. And I noted that actually he doesn't really provide an info dump until about 15% into the novel. I say that using Kindle because I wouldn't know what page it was. But there's actually very little info dumping. He allows the story to – do that rather
it does. It's well it, again. It's in Titus's head, so we only know what Titus knows and thinks, and Titus isn't going to explain stuff to himself so much that he assumes is common knowledge.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm just going to read you.
Please do.
This is a really great book. This is Titus explaining what school is like, and school is now spelt with a capital S and a TM at the end. And so here's Titus's explanation of this is what America has become now that it's corporatized and the feed is ubiquitous and everything. So now that school, TM, is run by the corporations, it's pretty brag because it teaches us how the world can be used, like mainly how to use our feeds. Also, it's good because that way we know that the big corps are made up of real human beings and not just jerks out for money because taking care of children, they care about America's future. It's an investment in tomorrow. When no one was going to pay for the public schools anymore and they were all like filled with guns and drugs and English teachers who were really pimps and stuff, some of the big media conglomerates got together and gave all this money and bought the schools so that all of them could have computers and pizza for lunch and stuff, which they gave for free. And now we do stuff in classes about how to work technology and how to find bargains and what's the best way to get a job and how to decorate our bedroom.
which is really cool. And that gives you a good idea of the language that it's written in.
And that's a perfect bit of world building. I mean,
it is. It's beautiful. And the language in this book is really clever too, because he's used this partially disintegrated language.
Yeah.
But it's
it's still very accessible though.
It's really accessible, and it's not it when I first started reading it, I was thinking, oh, this will get really this deliberately dumbed down kind of language is actually going to get quite, but it doesn't really get tired, because he's just able to use language in a way, because he has Titus, who, as Violet, who's the love interest, she's more than love interest, but she's the girl Titus has a crush on. As she points out, Titus is the only one of his group of friends who uses metaphor. So Titus is a little bit, more, I guess, cognitively developed than his friends.
Yes.
He will actually make connections about between things on his own without the feed.
Yes.
Just filling in the gap. So because he's M.T. Anderson has this character as his viewpoint character, he gets to still put in a lot of depth and texture.
I did feel I felt like he was switching off the neologisms and the language to get a point across sometimes. It just, because he could only go so far with what he said.
Sometimes, but I think the level, that, like on a syntax level and on a vocab level, it remains pretty.
You think so?
Yeah, it remains pretty even all the way through. It does develop as it goes along, but remember, he gets to know Violet.
Yeah, Titus develops as well.
Right,
that's
so
true.
Titus develops, and so his language, he becomes exposed to more stuff, and his language develops a little, but it's still, it's a really elegant way of using this sort of stripped back, deconstructed, sort of dumbed down, for want of a better word, type of language.
It's a bit like Valley speak.
Yeah, but still make it really accessible and not irritating.
Yes,
not,
it was never irritating. Yeah. I thought as well, like, this is going to get tiring really quick, but it never does. And also it's because Titus, even though he's a product of his world, he's still a very sympathetic character. There are times you want to kill him, especially in the last half of the novel.
Yeah, but in a
Sort of, I know you could be better, Titus. Why are you falling this way? That's why, you know, it's a good book, because you get that sort of.
Absolutely. This is actually the reason I recommended this book, and as regular listeners would know, we spoil the hell out of books, and we're really going to spoil this one, because I want to talk about the ending.
We have to talk about the ending.
So we're going to spoil it, basically. If you like how it sounded so far,
it's a really short book.
Switch
off.
Skip ahead to the next time point, which is in the show notes, and come back to this after you've read feed.
Tell them it's a short book.
It is a short book. It's really quick. Yes. Really quick. In fact, stop the podcast now. Go read the book. Come back. Keep it on pause. It'll be fine. It'll be done in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Anyway, the reason I recommended this book in particular was I was absolutely, for the last third of the book, I think I was just about on the verge of tears for the whole last third of the book. It was just, it was so tragic, but not in a sappy, sentimental way. It was just deeply, deeply humanly tragic happening.
I felt angry.
Angry at Titus or angry at the situation?
Angry at the situation and at Titus and at a world that's so built around consumerism that if you're not a consumer yourself, you can't get help.
Because what happens is Violet's feed, partially because
it's mostly because they get a virus.
Partially because she didn't get her feed till she was 7.
Yeah.
So it didn't take as well as when you get it when you're a baby. And partially and then because they got infected by this virus.
Yeah, on the moon, while they're on the moon.
Yeah. Her feed never quite recovered. And what eventually happens is that her feed shuts down her entire body, because the technology is so meshed into your biology that you can't get rid of it, and it controls you. It's a type of control
over
your body.
Yeah. This is the thing that bugged me, and I need to ask you, because remember I'm a bit new on this. Is this a form of reverse fridging or post-fridging? And what I mean is that Titus himself gets a lot of his character development from the fact that his girlfriend, Violet, is dying and then ends up, big spoiler, dying at the end. So she carks it. So it's as a result of a woman or a female, female, going through absolute fucking torture and dying at the end that Titus gets character development.
Yeah.
And isn't that what fridging is all about? Or that the character is, well, fridging is more, you know, literally you open up a fridge and find a corpse of a woman in there, and it gets you all upset, and then you go and find the murderer and get vengeance. But
I think that there's two things. I think that, I mean, the way the term is generally used is it is a, like a
it's
motivation.
A catalyst.
It's a catalyst. Yeah. So that the, whatever trauma and death that the woman went through is dismissed kind of at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
That's just the thing that happened that makes the man get all angry and revengeful and, yeah. and
which is why I'm talking this is like post-fridging, as in it's the fridging happens at the end of the story, not at the beginning.
Yeah, but
it's probably not fridging, but I'm using
this is what I'm trying to explain.
It did annoy me a little
bit. So it's not an inciting incident. It's not something that is then pushed away.
Right? No, it's critical.
Like here's this, yeah. you know, oh, what a pity your girlfriend slash wife slash lover slash sister died. Now go off and have your story and we never mind about her. Yeah. Except maybe at the end when you can come back and put flowers on her grave and say, there you go, I avenged your death. Which is the problem with that kind of a story. Yeah. But Violet, this is as much Violet's story as Titus's, literally, because we get great swathes from her point of view in terms of the emails that she sends and, yeah. And the chat that they have. So it's not pushing her aside. And, I mean, this is the thing. It's not – like every time you say, oh, that's – it's not that you can't – you can't even write a – you know, it's not that we're saying you can't write a book where you kill a wife and the husband goes off and has revenge. It's not like a scripture that you adhere to. It's just it's a pattern. And when you just see the same pattern over and over and over and over, that's where the problem is. It's not that there's necessarily I'm not saying there isn't in some things, in the individual things, there's wrong stuff. But, you know, overall, it's not that every single example of that is in itself a bad thing.
But is this world so fucked that Violet has to go through such torture and pain and eventual death for Titus to actually have a realization and epiphany about his place in the world? Is that what we're saying? Because without that, without Violet having to go through that sort of torture and pain, Titus just coasts along until – I mean, because the other thing is that we haven't mentioned is that the society is actually collapsing. It's a slow apocalypse. It's happening very slowly. They're getting
in America
weird,
anyway. In America. We're not quite sure what's happening with the rest of the world.
They're getting weird skin patches on them and
– The lesions. Yeah.
Which become a fashion statement, which is hilarious in and of itself. But something's going on. They're fucked. It's again, not entirely explained what it is. It's something genetic, obviously.
And something to do with the feed. And something to do with the pollution and all the environmental degradation.
It's very slow, but it is happening. So this society is going to cave in on itself and you know, die at some point. So,
which is another thing that I think makes this such a sad
because he's coasting, he becomes aware of it towards the end. Mm. Everyone else around him though doesn't because it's just normal to them.
Yeah.
As things get worse, they just – I mean, shit, they turn them into fashion trends. I mean, that's how fucked this society is.
But that's what kids do. When I was in high school, it was really trendy to get cold sores. Seriously.
No, it wasn't.
That's totally was.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
It was really trendy to need cold sores. And when I was in primary school, if you had the asthma – what are they called?
The inhalers.
Yeah. Really trendy.
I had an inhaler. It didn't help me.
Didn't help you?
No.
Primary school, that was the thing. The kids who had the inhalers.
What, to spritz on other people?
No, just because it was a special thing.
Yeah. I was colorblind. I got teased. I still am.
How did they even know?
Yeah, well, I couldn't tell colours, so, you know, they figured it out.
Okay.
Yeah, they thought I was lying. Anyway, really not the point. But, okay.
But that's the thing. So,
but it's not the kids as much as actively the society is making it a trend.
Teenagers pick up on stuff like that.
No, but the lesions are, you know, it's cool to have lesions because the feed tells you that it's cool now to have lesions.
Yes.
So the society is feeding it to you that it's.
Yeah.
And as I said, my point being, he only becomes aware of this because she.
Well, he gets a really close up.
And that's the question I'm asking you.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing?
Well, that's the story.
From a gender. Well, I know it's a story, but from as part of my gender awareness, is it?
Are we going to do this with every single book we talk about?
But I can't help it.
Oh, I have things to say about some kind of fairy tale.
Yeah,
but anyway,
and I have very similar, possibly similar things to say.
I think, as I said, it's not about individual works, and I think the fact that
actually some kind of fairy tale is the same. The man in that also.
We'll get to that.
But it's a similar thing, though.
Yeah, but we'll get to that. But I think with feed again, it's not you're putting together something. M.T. Anderson has Titus as his central character. If Titus had been gay and Violet had been another boy, but then you have the issue, or if Titus had been a girl and she'd fallen in love with a boy whose feed was broken. you can change dynamics with
But see, that would have been unexpected. That's my point. The fact that it's the girl that has to go through the torture and pain for the boy to get the realization.
Yeah, no, possibly. I mean, it is part of a larger pattern. But I think in this book...
It doesn't destroy the book, okay?
No, it doesn't.
I'm just saying it's something that I...
Yeah, no, it's definitely – it's look, the suffering woman is a trope that has resonated through culture for centuries. I mean, was it Poe who said there's nothing more beautiful than a woman suffering or a woman in pain or something like that? Hi, Edgar. I love you, but you're such a tosser sometimes. It's definitely a trope. And yes, it would have been different to have the girl being the protagonist and she fell in love with a boy that this happened to. On the other hand, I think doing that, he wouldn't have been able to, because in this world again, it's not gone anywhere far away from our world in terms of how genders are coded and what boys can do and what girls can do and all of that stuff. So he wouldn't have been able to mine some of that material, I think, if he'd had his genders
reversed.
Yeah, true.
That's true.
What I loved about Feed was that the character of Titus was so – especially in the last third, because she's dying and he's just deleting emails and ignoring
her. Yeah, because what
he's
saying, to stop giving me your burden, because he's not used to the whole idea.
But the thing is you just want to shake him sometimes, but you want to shake him because we're in our 30s.
Yeah.
Right? Closer to 40 than a 30. And you just want to go, come on, this isn't the thing what you do. But when you're 16 and you just met this girl 3 weeks ago and you didn't sign on for the whole Death Watch thing, she was just someone cool and fun to hang out with. And you didn't pledge undying love and suddenly you feel bad ditching her because she's dying, but you were going to ditch her anyway because she was weird.
Yeah.
And that was like half of my sorrow was for Violet because she's going through this horrible experience and no one will help her and the corporations won't help her, because she's not a useful resource to them. And half of it was for Titus because I could really feel like it's so you wanted to shake him, but you also wanted to just give him a hug.
The gut wrenching scenes when he's with the dad, with Violet's dad.
Yeah,
that's hard to read. Actually,
it was such a remarkable balance to achieve to write this character who objectively, really, you should think you're such a cock.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whack whack whack. Grow the fuck up. Go hold her hand, but he's able to write Titus and with this very, in some ways, limited vocabulary and limited means of expression. I mean, Titus doesn't get all flowery with how he feels.
No.
In fact, in some ways, I'm going to read this one part because I highlighted it, and I think it illustrates the writing and what Anderson is able to do with this really simple writing and why you're so affected by Titus. Okay, so I'm just going to read you this part. This is because Violet's been sending him pictures and emails and all the, I mean, she's really full on in the way that, you know, I guess only teenagers can be, because she loves Titus. She's decided she's in love with Titus,
yes,
right? And she's dying. So there's, you know, all this emotion. She's just throwing all this stuff at him. And so anyway, so Titus says, I didn't listen to any of them, any of the stories. I just kept them. I didn't touch them on the way home. They just bled. I got home. I had a headache. I told the feed to shut off the headache. It sent me a message about how much I was caching and asked if I wanted to open it. I sat down at the table and then walked around. She was bombarding me. Finally, I got a message that she'd stopped. My lines were clear. I went to the kitchen to get a drink of water. I filled a glass. I looked at the window over the sink. I deleted everything she had sent me. I went into the living room and sat on the sofa. I didn't feel good. I sat on the sofa. I looked at the fireplace. I had deleted all her memories. Later on, she chatted me saying, "What's your answer about the weekend idea? We'll have to sneak around my dad because he doesn't want me to see you, but don't worry, don't worry. We'll be together, whatever happens." I didn't know what weekend idea she was talking about, so I didn't answer her. The walls of my room were all white. They had hot spots where if you looked at them, posters would appear, but I shut them off. There was nothing on my walls. I didn't do my homework. I went to bed. I lied there face up. I didn't sleep. And that's just amazing. It just gives you chills.
It does. This,
you just get Titus's, his depression, his anxiety, everything he's feeling but not wanting to feel. It's just the most
beautiful. You're right. The balancing act in this novel is really fucking good, because that can only work if you've built Titus in the first half as a sympathetic character.
Yeah, and he's mildly sympathetic.
Well, he is. He's very sympathetic, because this is in a world where there's no one is.
Yeah,
this is a
they're all kind of vacuous of teenagers, and Titus is a little less vacuous than the others.
Well, but not just the teenagers; the adults are as bad.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, it's a world of vacuous teenagers.
Yeah,
whether you're 15 or whether you're 35, you're all of them.
And
are
yes, he's a little
teenagers.
Less. He's a little less, but not so much that he's other. He's still part of the gang.
Yeah, absolutely.
He still has the same wants and desires as his friends, but there's just that little bit, and that little bit is what allows you to gives you the entrance into him and makes him sympathetic, which means all that stuff makes it tougher to read.
Yeah, it hurts. It's one of the few books that I can remember reading, certainly recently, where I've really gotten like emotionally just messed up throughout the entire reading of a great chunk of it, not just a scene, not just a chapter, but like I think the last third of the book, that whole third where it's him and Violet and her sending messages and him deleting them, and you just want to go, Titus, but you understand why he isn't.
Does it need to be a science fiction novel though? Could you have done the same story without?
What would you be talking about?
What do you mean? I mean, she can be sending him text messages, Facebook posts.
Oh yeah, no. Well,
does it have to be science? Does it have to be set
if you were just going to take that plot line, then yeah, you
well, that
you
is the plot. That
it.
Is the story.
But no, but the story is not just about boy meets a girl.
No, it's world building.
Like, so after 3 weeks, she turns out to be dying. He doesn't know what to do. Oh dear, and then she dies. That's sort of the line that everything is built on.
And then there's
on.
A general commentary, you're right, about media consumerism.
Yeah, because why is she dying? And why is Titus uncomfortable? And why can't Titus access his feelings? Why doesn't Titus even have the words to talk about what he's feeling? I mean, this is the thing. He doesn't have the words. It's just...
So this is a cautionary tale.
It's a horrible, horrible world that's built up
This is a cautionary tale.
It absolutely is. It's such a good dystopic novel. I was so impressed by it. I need to go and read more of... he's written a vampire one. I'm really keen to read that.
Jason hasn't read it yet?
No, he hasn't. No,
There's a vampire novel out there that Jason hasn't read.
I know. I discovered M.T. Anderson. I brought him to our house and said, Jason, you need to read this. And he did, and he was a bit weepy as well.
She made
it's
Jason
such
cry.
A sad novel. But I think at the end, there's no hope for this world.
No.
And there's no hope for Titus either, or any of them. They're going down.
It's fucked.
Right. But, and this is, I was on a panel at Conflux where we were talking about sort of dystopia and you know, melancholy novels and all that sort of stuff and young adult stuff and blah, blah, blah. And people say, well, you know, you shouldn't have this and kids and blah, blah. And why is horror so dark and all that sort of stuff?
Sorry, what they were saying? What then? Why is horror so dark?
Yeah,
it's in the fucking term.
I know, but, you know, that's the thing. But why, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Why are we feeding our kids?
Why do you like it?
But also, why are we feeding our children or our teenagers this hopelessness?
But the thing is, I was sort of, it occurred to me, partially while I was talking, partially been something I've been thinking about for a while. But and one of the reasons I guess I like horror fiction and dark fantasy and all that sort of stuff is actually in a meta way, there's something actually incredibly hopeful about the whole thing, dystopic. The fact that you can look at it and say this is horrible is in itself a hope. The hope is in the reader. The hope is in the reader reading something that's dark and miserable and has no hope in itself and recognizing that and wanting to do something about that, even if it's only on a personal level. It's almost like you
it's
read
patronizing
it.
Of our teenagers that we feel that they can't get that message.
Oh, God, kids can get that message.
Of course they can, but it's patronizing. Oh, well, all they're going to do is walk away and want to kill themselves, which is not true. I mean, they may want to do that, but it won't be because of M.T. Anderson.
Well, I mean, there is feedback loops and confirmation bias and all that sort of stuff. But I think broadly speaking, certainly speaking for myself, actually, not so broadly speaking, but speaking for myself, because you get, you know, when you write horror and read a lot of horror, you get asked this question like every 5 minutes, like, why do you like that stuff? Why do you write it? But I think what I actually like about it is I feel, and this is, as I said, this is something I've only kind of just started to put into words, but I think I get a lot of reward out of actually putting myself in a position where you're kind of going up to the edge of the abyss.
Yep.
And if you can look away, there's satisfaction in that because you can look at how shit things sometimes really can be, and if you can still walk away and feel
that's the treasure,
that things
that's
are
the
okay.
treasure of fiction. That's what fiction is there to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, exactly.
To give a snippet of what could be.
And it's not that I'm – and I think most readers of horror and dark fiction, it's not necessarily that we're reveling in –
No, no, absolutely. Well, some of it. I mean, I'll like splatterpunk. But,
yeah, but that's a different kind of thing. Yeah. Right? You know, it's – but the fact that we can sort of wallow in it
yeah.
to a certain extent but still walk away – and
yep,
and,
that's right.
and feel that despite that awful thing, that awful world, that awful stuff, there's still something better.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect note.
And I think that's what Feed kind of does.
And I think that's a perfect note to end our conversation.
Okay.
Feed. I think that was because of what else can you say? I don't think we even have to discuss Graham Joyce.
Something yeah. better.
No, look, highly recommended.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary book. But in terms of character,
obviously,
in terms
you've heard of, this far, if it's been spoiled for you, but even if it has,
no, I think it's. I don't think you need to know the end. I think you can know the ending, and I think it's reading what he does with that stuff. Yeah. And plus, I mean, we've just given you bare bones. There's so much in there that's the world building, the way he talks
yeah,
about
this
how
this is a genuine science fiction novel. I want to make that clear.
Works.
This is a genuine.
Oh, absolutely.
This is not someone who's just taking the trappings of science fiction to tell a story.
He
has thought through the world building.
He's looking at the technology, he's looking at, and as we said at the beginning, Ian, it feels very much now. I mean, there's a bit of a tweak to the technology, but the immersion of the internet, the constant bombarding with consumerist messages via not just advertising but via all forms of media,
yep.
the policing of what you're meant to do and like and be, all of that, this is what this novel's about. And what happens when you are outside of that, when you have no value as a citizen, when you're not a citizen, in fact, anymore, when you're no longer a citizen of a country with a government, when you're just a resource for a corporation
yeah,
to access.
Absolutely. I call it.
And when you no longer have value, then what value do you have?
You brought up William Gibson, which was interesting, and I don't want to say too much more because we'll end up spending the whole podcast talking about this book. But I would call this like the new cyberpunk.
It's definitely a cyberpunk. I think anything which is talking about
neo cyberpunk.
I think it's just cyberpunk.
But
10 years old. We can't be too neo.
Well, people like Tim Maughan, who we spoke about, his paint thingamabobby.
I think it's all
because he's doing similar things.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are people who are doing that sort of SF, and it's a bit. I just want to. Can I have my own
When you're
term?
Talking about information technology,
I want my own term.
That's cyberpunk.
Can't I just call it new cyberpunk?
Okay. I guess it's the 21st century, isn't it? It's 2002.
No, that's a mouthful. New cyberpunk.
No, but I'm just saying it's the 21st century,
yeah.
So you can call it new cyberpunk now.
Yes.
Because cyberpunk will call 20th century. We'll rule a line. Never mind about scholarship. Me and you. Rule a line.
Yeah, rule a line.
2000.
Yeah.
Neo-cyberpunk.
Also known as new cyberpunk. Copyright Ian Monkhurst McDermott.
Yes,
really Ian Monkhurst and just got on the wagon to the end there. So next book.
Wanker.
Yes.
You, not the next book.
What? No, you were me.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next book's Fairy Punk. No, I don't want to get into the punk thing. I'm sorry. And I apologise. So I chose this one.
Yes, you did.
And I actually nominated
it. And I thank you because I've been meaning to read it for a year. So
yes.
That's good.
And I nominated it for also for a Hugo, but it didn't get up.
Oh.
What a surprise. It might get up on the World Fantasy Ballot, though, when that comes out. I can see this one.
Yeah, being, yeah.
This one appearing. Anyway, I'm going to read, unlike you, I'm going to read the blurb.
Okay.
So, yes. So this is Some Kind of Fairy Tale by Graham Joyce. It is Christmas afternoon and Peter Martin gets an unexpected phone call from his parents. It pulls him into a bewildering mystery. His sister, Tara, has come back home, not so unusual you might think. This is the time when families get together. But 20 years ago, Tara took a walk into the woods and never came back. And as the years have gone by with no word from her, the family has unspoken fear that she was dead. But now she's back, tired, disheveled, but happy, and full of stories about 20 years spent traveling the world, an epic odyssey taken on a whim. But her stories don't quite hang together. In the intervening years, have been very kind to Tara. She really does look no different from the young woman who walked out the door 20 years ago. Peter's parents are just delighted to have their little girl back, but Peter is not so sure. There is something about her, a haunted, otherworldly quality. Some would say it's as if she's off with the fairies. And as the months go by, Peter begins to suspect that the woods around their homes are not finished with Tara and his family.
Yeah, it's a very
And that last paragraph or that last thing makes out that there's some sort of impending evil about to descend.
It's a bit of a
which is
love.
Not the book at all.
And considering you find out that she says she's gone off with the fairies in what, chapter 3 or something, I mean, there's no point really holding that back. And it's called some kind of fairy tale. So, you know,
yeah, so essentially Tara disappears for 20 years and turns back up and she's only aged – well, she says she's only been gone for 6 months.
And she looks younger than she might otherwise be. She was meant to be 36 or
– correct.
Yeah.
And she says she's been off to a secondary world with fairies.
Except she doesn't actually say fairies.
No.
Well, she makes a good point all throughout the book of saying they don't call them fairies. They don't like the word fairies.
Yes.
But they're fairies.
Yes.
I mean, Graham Joyce is quite clear. They're fairies. They're fairies.
Yeah. And I chose this because of the beautiful writing and I found it captivating and enthralling. And yes, I have a couple of issues with it, but then there's no such thing as a perfect book. But I thought it was definitely worth I think Joyce is a fantastic writer.
Yes.
And I think this is a very, very good book. As I said, I do have problems with it and I think we're going to have the same problem. But this is about Richie and Tara, I assume. Yeah? No?
No, not – well, that's part of it, yeah.
Okay.
I did like the book. The last book of Graham Joyce's I've read was some Limits of Enchantment.
Yep.
Which I think is it's a masterwork in the sense of treading that line – treading the liminal between – is it magic? Is she just a bit weird? That book never comes down on one side or the other. And I love that book for that. I think.
What about this one, Kirsten?
This one definitely comes down. It picks a side.
Yes.
And I think that's what, by the end, it was like,
yeah,
picked a side.
I think the
Limits of Enchantment, which we're not talking about, but I'll just briefly say that. Because it's not a spoiler, but basically, yeah, it's a beautiful book. It's a fantastic world that he builds, which is our world. I mean, he's not building a third world or anything, but the world building in the book, in terms of the character and how she sees the world, and it is just wonderful. And you're kind of suspended in this sort of liminal plane throughout the entire book, and left there at the end, and it's quite an exquisite. Quite an exquisite thing, and there's some kind of fairy tale. Every chapter is prefaced with a quote from somewhere about fairies and fairy tales and so on. And there's one that talks about how might even be a Joseph Campbell quote. I can't remember. I should have marked it, but how you don't need to know everything. Part of growing up is realizing that you don't need to know everything. And I think the Limits of Enchantment sort of encompasses that beautifully, because you get to the end, you don't know exactly, but it doesn't matter unless you're one of those people who just has to know. But it's a really beautiful book, and it's kind of where I was hoping some kind of fairy tale was going. But I think by the end, he comes down pretty clearly on, spoilers, on the side of the fairies.
Yes. There. Now, there are two reviews on the interwebs, which we'll link to. When I say we, I mean Kirsten.
You better send me the links, because I haven't looked at any reviews.
One is by Ben Godby from Strange Horizons, and one is by Charlie Jane Anders on IO9. And they are different in that Godby argues that the problem he has with the book is that Joyce seems to be trying to have his cake and eat it. So there's this feeling that we're meant to doubt, that we're meant to feel that there's an ambiguity here. Over Tara, whether she's actually been off with the fairies or not. But the book never really allows us to have that ambiguity, but it seems to want us to. There's a paradox, because she's gone to a psychologist or psychiatrist, Vivian, and there's that sense of deconstructing and trying to find holes in her story and yet it's quite clear from the actual evidence that she hasn't aged that much, that There's someone else in the town who's had a very similar experience. Not that that necessarily proves anything, but still, you know, that Joyce himself as the author is not is clear that this is a fairy. She's gone off with the fairies.
I think
Charlie Jane Anders, on the other hand, says that that's actually a strength of the book, that Joyce isn't trying to create this sense of ambiguity, that it's actually clearly about a girl who goes off for 6 months with the fairies, and that what the Vivian thing is just another perspective to her story.
Yeah.
And that's – I found that really – and that's why I want to link to both these reviews because
okay.
Because it is that interesting.
It's a different reading of the
book.
From,
that's yeah, that's right. And I wasn't sure – I wasn't sure what side I was on, but I think I'm more on Charlie Anders' side because I think there were times when I was wondering, Joyce, do you really want us to question this? Do you want us to – are you trying to get us to question whether she's gone off or not? And there are times I think he sort of is trying to put a slither of doubt in there. But it's it never holds fast.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's difficult because when Tara is telling her story, she's most of the book is in third person.
Yes,
most of the narrative, I should say, is in third person. But then you'll get when Tara is telling her story of what happened to her, that's in first person and quite a different vernacular to the narrator. And then you have some first person from Richie as well. And then, of course, you have, the doctor when he's writing his notes. That's also in Vivian. First person. Yes, Vivian.
Well, they make a gag about him having a female name. But anyway.
It's actually a male name.
I know. So that's part of the gag. Oh, whatever. Anyway. Don't start with Evelyn Warham.
I say so. It's Evelyn. But because Tara's story is the first piece of first person that we get, that's not this very genteel narrating voice, which is telling you a story from the get-go, I think she comes across so powerfully and her story comes across with a lot of truthfulness.
Yep.
So you're much more accepting of what Tara is telling you than a narrator who, by his or her own admission, is making some stuff up.
Yes.
Because they weren't there they're telling you that
and
from
I didn't
the first
get that.
Paragraph.
I didn't get any of that. I don't know why he bookended the story in that way.
It's odd.
And that was something that Godby had a problem with because what
it's
what
an odd,
are you trying to create a doubt in us by doing that?
I think there's – well,
and that's where I do
this
agree.
This was an odd reading experience, I have to say, because I felt and I appreciated that the book was at once wanting to provide you with that shaky ground, so you didn't necessarily know what you were doing throughout the book, while explicitly telling you it was a book by using the quotes at the beginning, by using certain narrative devices. You were always conscious you're reading a book. This is not a book masquerading as, except that it is. But then there was this weird – did you pick up the things with the animals and the gender? Did you skate over it?
I skated over
it. Okay. I got to read you this. Okay. I am – there's this bit – near the beginning, it's like only in the first few chapters, and it's just a throwaway bit, but I thought it was possibly not a throwaway bit. So this is Tara and Peter talking about a dog that the family had had before Tara left. And Tara asked Peter, "Where is Nyx, by the way?" "Hell, Tara, Nyx died about 15 years ago. Dad buried her in the garden in the rose bed." "Oh, of course." Then Tara had cried bitterly. "We had some lovely roses come from where we buried him." And I went, "Oh, that's an unfortunate typo. Didn't get picked up in edits. Never mind." But then, about a chapter or so later, when Tara is talking, she meets Yarrow.
Yep.
Who's taking her away to Fairyland. And she meets him and he's on a horse, a white horse. And she says to him, "That's the whitest horse I've ever seen." "It is," he said. "It's the whitest horse you've ever seen and it's the whitest horse you will ever see and that's why he's mine." And then just a few over the page and then for the rest of the book, whenever this horse is mentioned, he says, "The horse, no, she won't go far from me. She's my best friend in the world."
So how do you explain it?
And I thought, oh, well, then there's two. He's doing something weird with the animals and the gender and but they're the only two. So now I think maybe, but.
But what's the point of it?
I don't think there is a point. I actually think it was a mistake now. Having read the whole book, okay. I think it's an error that just didn't get picked up, which is unfortunate because I did spend the whole book, because there's a cat later, and I kept waiting for its gender to switch. To the point where I went and reread the first bit where it got mentioned, but it was just an it all the way through, and then later it became a he, and I'm going, hey, he's going to be a she soon, never did. So I think actually it was just an unfortunate couple of typos. I'd love to hear that I'm wrong, but because it never gets done again, but the fact is because they were there and because the whole book has this kind of shakiness, unreliable narrator kind of thing to it, I kept kind of looking for them and it was a bit of a distraction. Yeah. So then I was also looking at other odd things and I think I was looking too closely at stuff.
It comes down to what do you think the purpose of this book is?
Yeah.
The Godby review seems to think that the unreliableness is part of what the book's about, but it fails to do that properly.
I think I'd probably agree with him.
The Charlie Jane Anders view is that this is a book about perspectives based on the fact that someone has left you. We've just had it now, Cleveland, you know, these girls who have been found after 10, 12 years.
Yep.
You know, they've disappeared, they've come back, and that how do people deal with it, you know? Especially Richie, who was actually arrested for potentially killing Tara or absconding away with her or whatever.
Yeah.
So now that the person's back, what's the consequence? You know, the consequences of the action of them disappearing, plus then now that they're back, what happens after that? That's – and the many perspectives that converge on that. That's what – at least if I'm reading Charlie Jane Anders' review correctly, that's what she got out of the book.
And I think that would have worked
And I think that's what you are meant to get out of the book.
Well, and I think that would have worked a lot better if I didn't feel that the book came down so heavily on the side of the fairies are real and that's where Tara's
point. That's the point. It comes so heavily on that because that's not the question to ask.
Yeah.
Because that isn't a question. She's disappeared and she went off with the fairies. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Now what we're looking at is what happens when someone comes back and says mad shit about being off with the fairies. How do you deal with it? Especially when they've been gone for 20 years.
But if it's true, you deal with it in a different way, don't you? That's what I mean. That's where I think it falls down.
Why?
Because if it's true, you deal with it in a different way.
Yeah, but
here's the thing, because one of the things that Joyce prefaces the chapters with is this ongoing story from a transcript of a trial where a man and his family were accused of murdering his wife because he thought...
Which is a true story.
Yeah, which is a true story, yeah. Because he thought she'd gone off with the fairies yeah. and a changeling had been substituted in her place. And so they essentially tortured this poor woman to death in an attempt to prove she was a fairy. So that's the world you get when you believe fairies are real, right? And your wife comes back and says, I've been away with the fairies for 6 months. That's the world you get. The world we have is when your sister comes back and says, I've been away with the fairies for 6 months and you don't believe her, right? It's a different world. If you believe in the fairies, which we are asked to do as readers,
no, but isn't,
it's a different
Joyce
reaction.
isn't expecting them to believe her.
No, but he doesn't, but he wants the readers to.
Yes. We're
which
on
is her. Different. So our perspective is different. It is different to that of the family. And we are meant to feel, if not superior, at least more in the know than them. Oh, if only they believed her because she's telling the truth. And their reaction,
that was the genius of the book, though.
But the thing is, their reaction would – but here's the thing, right? Because he's not leaving it as a is it or isn't it. He's not asking the readers to make a choice. He's giving us
the
answer.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
Right. So therefore, we're kind of one up on the family and we can sit – instead of sitting back there with the family going, well, I don't know whether to believe her or not. And if it's true, this is what we have to do. And if it's not true, and what do we do? What do we do? Because we don't know what to do. As readers, as much as the family doesn't know what to do, even though they clearly don't believe in the family, although Richie by the end is going, maybe the fairies or something. Instead, we're given kind of one up on the family. So we're just sitting there going, well, we'll just believe her. If you only believed her – like a lot of the scenes he writes.
I never felt patronised.
It's not
superior, patronising.
And like I said, superior is in terms of.
I thought he did it brilliantly. I thought I still felt for her brother, the mother and father, for Richie, for everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, she's telling the truth and they can't believe it. I didn't think, oh, fuck, just believe it. I thought, actually, no.
No. It's not that we're sitting there because we wouldn't expect them to believe her, right? But we're
able... Well, I don't know. The fantasy trope thing is that, that halfway through the novel, everyone just sort of clicks and goes, oh, it really was true. Yeah. You know, and that never happens.
Well, Richie kind of does.
Kind of does, only because his cancer vanishes.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is I think we're not... When we're not given an even playing field with the family, we're given privileged information. The author's winking at us and going, yeah, but you know, right? You know, she's with the fairies. You know that, even if they don't. So even though it's not that we're patronising or whether we're feeling morally superior or something, we do know. We know something they don't.
But isn't Joyce saying, even though we know the reader, there are still consequences to her turning up 20 years later?
Yeah, oh, there are. But
and that's what he's dealing with. That's what the story deals with.
Sure, but what I'm saying is...
And one of those consequences is sending her to a psychiatrist to have her story taken apart.
Yeah, and 50 years earlier, one of the consequences of being locked in an asylum and electrocuted, as what happens with the old woman who she later meets.
Yes.
But if that's the story, though, if you say the fairies aren't real, there's a lot of stuff that's left unexamined in this book about that situation.
Such as that
kind of gets a free pass because we, as the reader, knows.
Yeah, but what?
What happened to her? What happened to her? What horrible thing happened to her that made her forget her 20 years? And what effect is that having on her now? Where has she gone now that she's run away? And does she need help still? And we don't need to talk about any of this because we know, as the reader, she's gone off to the fairies.
I see.
Which, really, I'm worried about her. The fairies are fucking evil.
Yeah, no, I want to get back to the fairies in a sec, but I see where you're coming from.
So you know, it gives it a sense
Joyce
of
free pass as a writer, not having to deal with her trauma.
There's a whole bunch of stuff we don't have to worry about because as the reader, wink, wink, nod, nod, we know her story's true.
And the problem is that he's waved it in front of us.
And yet the family who don't have this again. Like, what happened to her again? Where did she go? This hasn't been resolved for them. She's gone again.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. Maybe Godby's right. He doesn't say it this way, but maybe Godby is right that he's trying to have his cake and eat it.
I just think that would have been a lot more effective if we, as the family, we were still in the dark. We had to make up our own minds.
But obviously he didn't want to write that story.
No, he didn't. He didn't. And then that's fine.
And I suppose you've got to ask, well, then why has he teased us? In a sense, as if that it was that type of story, that's the lovely complexity of this book that I really got a lot out of.
Oh, look, I did. Look, I enjoyed reading it. I did.
There were problems, like the fairies themselves. Yeah, fine, whatever. But then one of them comes back and is a violent asshole, and it's the one that took her. That was the thing I just did not get at all. I didn't understand it. Didn't need to be part of the book. She gets taken by this fairy on a horse. Into the fairyland, then two fairies fight for her love. By the way, sex is very permissive in fairyland, and there's sex everywhere and orgies left, right, and centre. Great. So the two fairies fight. The fairy that took her on the horse dies, or he gets mortally wounded, but then is reborn. But when he's reborn, he's an arsehole.
Well, he's still Yarrow. That's what.
No,
but
he's a completely different character.
No,
than he was. He's a friendly, lovely. Yarrow of the very first part when he first takes her is not the same Yarrow who belts up
because she leaves.
Richie.
When he first comes back, he's nice. He only starts getting horrible when he realizes she actually is going to leave. You read those couple of chapters carefully.
To me,
he comes back, he embraces her, he still follows her round, he's still really nice, there's no problem with the other guy, there's no jealousy, it's all really, really nice until Tara wants to leave.
He said to her, you can leave, at the very beginning.
But he doesn't think she's going to.
And it feels genuine.
Because it's not until at the very end when he said, give it 6 months, and they have their drinky and their oath and all of that sort of stuff, right? But he says, yes, in 6 months. I give it 6 months, and then if you want to leave. It's always the carrot. It's always the thing that's held out.
I actually read Yarrow as being genuine.
He is genuine, but he doesn't think she's going to – he thinks after 6 months she's not going
to
leave.
We don't really get a perspective from Yarrow, so it's hard to know that he genuinely doesn't think she's going to leave.
Well
– Because he becomes an asshole.
Because she leaves. Because she has the temerity to actually leave his perfect world. His perfect, hypocritical, horrible, nasty
orgy
world.
Fairy world.
Do
you think Joyce is commenting on?
I think
because I don't know enough about British folklore to know how this matches up to. I mean, I've read Among Others as well, which also has a fairy element.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about fairies and British folklore to know whether this is playing with that or not. Or
oh, it's playing with it, but it's also. It's making the fairies, I guess, one of the characters said in the book, they're like just a 70s hippie commune or maybe a cult, like a Charles Manson sort of a cult thing. I found it fascinating and to some extent repellent. And I think, and I don't know whether it's deliberate on the part of Joyce or if it's just my reading of it, but the mirroring of the fairy world and our world in terms of the patriarchal structures, the ownership of the women by the men.
Okay.
The one female fairy who's named in the other world, Echo.
But there's no ownership there. She fucks whoever she wants to fuck.
Ah, but she says to Tara, see, this is the hypocrisy of the fairy world, is that, oh, it's all just sex and sex is nothing. It's like sharing a sandwich.
Yep.
Right? It's just, which, you know, is great and lovely and ideal and it's kind of, you know, the way, and we should all be enlightened and not a problem. But if it's so just throw away and it's just fun and here, have half my sandwich, I've just nibbled the corner, then why is Silky literally pining to death because he doesn't get to fuck Tara? Because and why is that Tara's fault? And why is Tara told by Echo, go on, it's your fault, you're here, not putting out, you're the reason he's pining to death. Please go and fuck him because you're the reason. If sex is so throwaway, it's like, here, Ian, have a sandwich. I don't want a sandwich. No worries. I'll find someone else to share my sandwich. Not a big deal. But it is a big deal, and the fairies fucking know it. And it's just a big deal in fairy world as it is in our world.
Yep.
And they're just as hypocritical, except in their world, the hypocrisy comes from the idea of free love and there's no sexual jealousy and there's no sexual ramifications. I mean, there certainly doesn't seem to be any pregnancy. You know, and therefore it's all wonderful and there's no point and there's none of this horrible human, you know, tying yourself up in knots and all this horrible
unless
stuff.
Unless you say no to their culture.
Unless you say no to their culture. Okay. Unless you actually have the temerity to be a woman there who doesn't open their legs.
Okay, that gives a bit of because I didn't see the point of having Yarrow in our world knocking Richie out and all that. So I just
and that's
see.
Why. And if you leave, if you have the temerity as a woman to leave Fairyland, especially without having opened your legs, they will fucking come and take you back, or at least they will hurt everyone you could possibly have a romantic relationship with for the rest of your life.
But you're right, and this is something that I got
they
from the book
awful.
As well. And I don't mean to sound negative.
They have incredible sexual jealousy and incredible sexual possessiveness, actually just hiding as sexual permissiveness.
Yeah,
awful.
Yeah. And as I was about to say. But I interrupted you, so I'm sorry. No, that was my fault.
On my rant.
No, it was a good rant. Even though I do love this book, gender-wise it doesn't come out well because, see, Tara comes off as, I mean, she's only 15 and a half.
Yeah, so she's, which is why Yarrow has to take her back. And, oh, dear, oh, that's her fault too. That's her fault too, he says.
She's quite immature. There really aren't any
Well, Genevieve is the mother figure, as it were.
Yeah, but that's all. But again, that's something Godby put. Sorry to use your second name, Ben pointed out in his review that there aren't enough other strong character arcs, and the women fall foul of that, and including Tara, who doesn't really come off as a fully fledged
but
character.
Here's the
brother, the men do though. Yeah. Like Richie, the Richie story is fully fledged, and of course Jack, who we haven't mentioned yet.
The son.
Jack and the cat.
Yeah.
Which you think, what the fuck's this doing in this story? I mean, what's the whole point of this?
And here's the thing, right?
It's amazing, though. The whole Jack storyline.
Jack and the cat. And
guilt about having shot the cat.
Oh,
and,
spoiler. It's a ginger cat, by the way. I had to see that coming.
Jack has an air rifle, gets it for his birthday, shoots a ginger cat. The cat dies. Never changes sex, though.
No.
And then Jack has guilt about the cat because it was owned by an old lady who he helped set up her internet. And there's this whole B plot going on that is only
with Jack and the cat, and the old lady.
Jack and the cat and the old lady. And we finally find out the old lady also went into Fairyland.
Yeah.
And that's the entire reason we have the Jack and the cat in the Fairyland. And the old lady story is to have that revelation at the very end that she went to, which in a sense annoyed me because I thought actually you could have taken that bit out and just made that into an astonishingly good short story. Because the bit when the old lady says, yes, I knew you killed my cat and I've known for all this time,
but this
is fucking amazing.
I know, but this is the thing, and this is it's a mirror. It's a mirror of the cat and the changeling.
Is it though?
It is, because this is a changeling. Her cat's been taken away and a changeling is brought back in the cat's place with an attempt to shove it into her life and saying, here is your changeling cat, right?
Yes, okay.
So it's a mirroring in very concrete terms.
I'm sorry, Graham, I missed that.
And that's what makes her realise the impact of everything.
Yeah, I still would have...
Which the reader knows from day one. It's like, you can't take an old lady to the cat. Yeah. I don't care if it's identical. She's going to know that from the heartbeat. You know?
It's so good, that yeah. thread, that I just wish it wasn't in this book.
Yeah. Oh, no, so I think it mirrors in really nicely. I think, but what, I mean, the other thing
The way you've said it, again, you've yes.
Yeah, but I mean, what I find, like, so you have this, and again, I like the book and I find all this stuff really interesting and fascinating to read and pull apart.
If you were Graham Joyce sitting, you'd think, oh.
Because I think this is the kind of book that kind of provokes this.
Okay.
You know, but when you have, so you have that Safari one, and that's how they are, and there's all that crap that we have now, but it's just in disguise, as fairies do, because they're evil.
You really hate fairies.
But in I hate these fairies, but in our world, it's the same. I mean, you have a look at Peter, who's kind of a nice guy, but how does he view his daughters? I mean, they're his possessions. The very last scene is him claiming a very clear ownership over Zoe and telling her she can't go off with that fairy. Right? He's a very clear ownership. You do not have your own free will, my dear.
Yep.
And it's between him and the fairy.
Yeah, but that's a
and
consequence.
And he talks about.
But that's a consequence of what happened to his sister.
No. But he hasn't.
So he is very possessive of his own children, especially his daughters, because he saw his parents go through a similar problem that they obviously gave, in his mind, possibly, the father and mother gave Tara so much core to run. That made no sense, but gave her so much latitude that she went off and disappeared for 20 years. And who knows what's happened to her.
Yes.
So he's going to be much tighter. That's the way I read it.
Oh,
him.
I know.
I don't read it as a sort of a paternal. Well, it is paternalistic,
but it is,
obviously.
But that's what it is. It is the father having the control of the daughters, especially the sexual control of the daughters. Because does he ever say anything about Jack? Jack going off when he's older. Jack getting a girl in trouble.
But a Jack analogue didn't go missing in his early life.
No, but this is what I'm saying. But a child could go missing, right? The same concern and the same policing.
No, I don't agree with you. I don't agree with you on this.
You can, but I'm just saying, like, the words he used to – I mean, he talks about how his girls don't dress like Hollywood hookers, right? There is this policing again. And this is what I'm saying. This is a reflection. And as I said, Peter's nice. Peter's affable. But this is what I'm saying. Even the nice guys.
But this is quite a conservative small town. This is not.
But this is what I'm
progressive
saying.
Progressive New York.
But this is what I'm saying. Okay. Like, even the nice guys. And I'm not saying Peter has any. Like, he's not bad. He has no.
All right. Okay.
Malicious designs towards his daughters. He wants the best. He genuinely wants the best for his daughters. But this is how it manifests in our society. And that's how it manifests in Fairyland, and it's the same coin.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Is this a good? But is this Joyce doing a good thing or?
I don't know how much is deliberate in the book, and as I said, how much I'm just reading from it. But I find it fascinating that we have, and again, it revolves around sexuality. It revolves around explicitly what women do with their sexuality.
Yes, I agree. And I really do, but I also see in that.
And we just have.
That comes clearly out in the Richie Tara relationship because Richie being all icky about how can I be back with Tara? She's only 15. If I believe she's only 15.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Am I a pedophile or what's going on here? Because I'm still attracted to
her. And the social.
But it's all about him. It's about his choice.
And we have our social narratives. I mean, this is some kind of fairy tale, which, you know, and the way the book is structured with the quotes at the front and the different types of narratives, it's very clearly, it's a book. This is a book you're reading. This is not. As I said before, it's not a book masquerading as something else. It's a book you're reading. And when we're talking about fairy tales, you're talking about cultural stories. You're talking about this, cultural narratives of our world. And our cultural narratives, some of the most defining cultural narratives we have are concerned about women and their sexuality and girls and their sexuality and who gets to own that and who gets to tell them what they can do. And, oh, my God, if you do the wrong thing, if you sleep with too many boys, if you get pregnant, if you have an abortion, if you don't have an abortion, all of this stuff, these are all the stories. So the girl who gets abducted because she has an abortion, the girl who gets abducted because she goes with the wrong guy, these are our dark fairy tales. We tell them all the time.
Yeah, true.
We see them on the news. It happens. It, like, those girls who got found. I mean, these are our social fairy tales. We have them. These are our stories. And this is what's in this book. Because what happened to Tara? If we don't get to decide that she didn't go with the fairies, what happened to Tara?
Yeah.
She went off with someone. She got abducted. She probably got sexually abused and kidnapped and held in a cellar for 15 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is our fairy tale. These are our stories. this is a fascinating book to talk about this subject matter. And as I said, I don't know how much of this is in the book and how much of this is my reading, but that's part of what makes it such a good book, because it's there and it.
It's,
you
know. No, it is there. And again, we can't, I mean, without having Graeme Joyce here, we can't know, but I think that sort of crunchiness is all there. It's there in the text. And
I mean, I think the metaphor that, because again, I think a lot of it is there deliberately, and by explicitly having the Cleary story there with the woman who was tortured to death,
yeah.
Framing these stories, and it's presented in about six or seven parts. It's not just one little bit above a chapter. That's another fairy tale that's told throughout the story, and that one's a true fairy tale. Yeah. And again, it's looking at our ideas of abduction, of being replaced, of having your children taken away, of having your loved ones taken away, what that actually means and how it's not nice. And I think his portrayal of fairyland, even though it's never called that, in this story is remarkable, because it does all of that and it follows it up, and it does the whole thing where the girl who's abducted is made to feel it's her fault. You know, I mean, Yarrow takes her away, and Yarrow is an awesome name, and that's one thing the doctor didn't talk about when he's talking about all his analysis of stuff. He doesn't mention Yarrow. Yarrow is it's a herb, and it's has a lot of folkloric and mythical properties, but two very important ones, especially in Celtic and pagan folklore, they revolve around love and fidelity. There's one where you can put it sounds a bit funny, you kind of stick a bit of yarrow up your nose, wiggle it around, and you say this poem / spell, and if your nose bleeds, your lover is true to you. The fact that yarrow has a nasal irritant in your nose will almost always bleed if you shove a bit of yarrow up there. I mean, that's the thing. And there's another one, I think if you put yarrow under your pillow, you dream of your true love or something. But there are several things with revolve around love and fidelity, and that's what he calls himself, even though it's not spelt like that. It's spelt kind of hero, and that's what the psychiatrist makes a big deal of. But yarrow is this, it's also a witch's herb. It has a lot of different names. And there was
Did you know this before you read the book?
Yeah, no, I know okay. about yarrow. So it's a really interesting name to give him as an alternate name. And but that's the thing, like Tara, like when she goes away with him, and after he's taken her to fairyland, after he's abducted her, then he says, "Oh, how old are you? Oh, you're 15. Oh, now I'm going to have to take you back."
Yeah.
Like it's such a why didn't you, young girl, tell your abductor how old you were before I abducted you? You know, it's like everything is back down on blaming the victim, which I think is great. I think it's a fantastic portrayal of what would happen in a situation where Peter, there were no fairies.
Peter blames her, Richie. Doesn't know. Richie's actually probably the most complex character, I think, in the whole book, and he's conflicted. He doesn't know whether to blame her, but also whether to fall in love with her again. And it's interesting that he gets cancer as a result of being in just even in proximity of her.
Yeah, and then Tara has to go away to save him.
Yeah,
it's like she has to go back to fairyland.
Yeah, but the old lady seems to make out that. So this is what you're saying about fairyland, and that really it's just the same coin, the same our fucked up world, reflected. But she seems to think, well, no, actually, going back to fairyland isn't such a bad thing. She wished she'd done it herself.
Would she have done it if, when she had gotten out of the mental asylum and everything, but she'd married that guy who she found, who she fell in love with?
Yeah,
this is the old woman, and she married him, and they had 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
If the fairies hadn't come back and killed him, would she have wanted to go back to fairyland, or would she have been quite happy in that new relationship in our world that she'd found with someone who accepted her and her stories for what she was? It's this really complex metaphorical portrayal of what it would mean to be in that kind of long-term abduction where you are constantly manipulated with kindness one day and cruelty another day and told you're not worth anything. And if you go back, they won't like you anyway. And I mean, we have, again, true, but they have become a cultural story of people who are abducted and for decades sometimes.
Yep, that's right.
You know, and why didn't you run away? Well, what? I'm not worth anything. They told me I wouldn't. They told me I'd get in trouble. They told me, look, we've raped you 50,000 times. Now you're not worth anything.
Yeah, you're tainted and broken.
These are our stories. I think this is a really fascinating book. Again, I think I would have liked it better if
I still would have liked the Jack story as its own story.
Unable to resolve itself at the end, because I think that would have left that a lot open. I think by explicitly saying yes, they were fairies, I think we get to write a line under a lot of stuff that we otherwise would trouble us a bit more. And I'm really not sure what that narrator is. That narrating device.
I didn't get,
because the narrator kind of has to be someone from fairy.
It could be Yarrow.
That's kind of what I'm coming down at, which means we are then getting Tara's story from her abductor.
Yeah, which is icky.
Which is really
It's skeevy, yeah. Look, we could speak longer again on this. Highly recommend it. It's very crunchy. There are, you know, I think we've canvassed quite a bit.
I think
you've definitely gotten – I thought I was going to get all heated in the face about it. But you've
I should say I liked the book. I liked reading the book. And it wasn't a book that I found some of the stuff quite repellent, but not in a like I think this is a terrible book kind of way.
Yeah.
Just in a way of how it was illustrating in very visceral ways.
Yep.
These kind of themes and subject matter, while again doing what specfic really does have as its largest bow in its quiver is being able to talk about stuff without talking about stuff.
Yeah, and that's right. And again, you could argue, well, why do we even need fairy in this? This could just be like Room by Emma Donoghue, about a story about an abduction.
Yeah.
You know, but you need – and again, I suppose it comes back to the argument of is this about that ambiguity or not about that ambiguity? And is the fairy bit in there to create that ambiguity, or is the fairy bit in there to ask a whole bunch of other questions, which is what I – think it's doing. But anyway, look, we've discussed that at length. So let's wrap this up.
Indeed. Next month.
In fact, literally 4 weeks from now.
Yes. Very exciting. Continuum, the Melbourne Specfic and Pop Culture Convention, is on again. And we are again doing one of our live audience records for this podcast with N.K. Jemison, who is one of the guests of the convention and who will be our guest on our podcast.
Yes, and she's recommended both things
that
we're reading.
She has, because as we said at the beginning, we're no longer doing more than two books in a podcast.
Never again.
Never again. N.K. Jemison actually sent us a list of books that she'd like to recommend, so we picked two. So it was kind of a group recommendation, I guess. So the two books are, the first is A Madness of Angels by Kate Griffin, who I've been meaning to read this for a while, so I'm very happy about that. And then the second one is a graphic novel.
And it's a great one. I love that she chose this.
Which is Saga, which is written by Brian K. Vaughan and illustrated by Fiona Staples. I hadn't actually consciously come across this book before, but then when I went online to buy it, I saw that cover, and I'd seen that cover several times before. It's an awesome cover.
Yes.
It's a great cover.
The breastfeeding cover. Which caused a lot of controversy, which I'm pretty sure we'll discuss. Yeah, people said, oh, you're kind of breastfeeding on the front of a comic.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, well, you know. I'm pretty sure we'll discuss
that. That makes me a little bit stabby. I'll have to look into that.
Now, I will say, N.K. Jemison made this very clear to us, that we're only discussing the first six issues.
Yes.
Or
whatever's in the trade paperback.
So we're not discussing, because issue 12 came out a couple of weeks
ago. Yeah, it's ongoing, so we don't want to give spoilers to people who may not have quite caught up yet,
correct,
because this is not a book that you
Although the second trade is only coming out this month.
Okay.
I wish I was Grant Watson here because he'd know. We're still only doing the first one, though.
Yes. I believe you've read more than that.
So I won't read any. I will not say anything about anything post issue 6.
And I won't, because I won't have read anything.
No.
Well, I might get to the end and go, oh, give me more.
It's Nora, isn't it? It's
Nora.
I can't just call her N.K. Jemison.
Please don't call her N.K. You may call her Nora.
Anyway, so Nora has made that, and we will absolutely abide by that. So
yes. If
anyone in the audience wants to talk about issues 7 to 12, well, they have to just leave.
They will.
Or I'll kick them.
Or we can edit it out. We're quite happy to talk about it in live, I guess, and I'll edit it out for the podcast, because I figure if you come to the room, you can always just leave the room.
So we just censor them.
So if you are in Melbourne and you are coming to Continuum over the June long weekend, look up our podcast on the program and come along. We'd love to have you in the audience.
It's on the Saturday from 3 till 5.
There you go. You're so much better organized.
Because it's the only thing I'm doing. Anyway, I'll end the stuff on the Friday night. But so that's that.
I'm doing a lot.
So that's it.
All right. So that's it for today. If you need need. If you want to send us feedback, I mean, if you need to, feel free.
You feel obligated, actually.
but you can comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can send us email to writerandcritic@gmail.com. You can always follow us on Twitter or just tweet us over there.
Now, Kirsten said I'm the tweeter person, but you tweeted the last time that the podcast went on.
Our Twitter handle is... Writer and critic. And
no, you said it was me always doing the tweets, but you did a tweet and people think it was me and it wasn't. It was you.
Well, I always do the one when I put the episode up, but then log back out again and it's all yours. Because you don't know. If I email you and say, put the episode up, tweet about it, it could be another day. So apart from the tweet that says, here's the new episode, you'll be talking to Ian on Twitter. If you email us, you can get either of us. And if you comment on the website, it's usually me who responds. You can also leave us a rating on iTunes of any star level you wish.
Five. That's one you can choose.
That is one.
There are four other numbers. I don't know them. And on that note.
On that note.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, now we have to wait for you to finish your dinner.
Right.
It sounds disgusting.
It doesn't.
I can hear it. It sounds disgusting. We both sound disgusting.
We sound natural.
We sound like we're talking with our mouth full, which is disgusting.
No, it's not.
No,
it's sensual. No, disgusting is what went. That's disgusting.